Hi, this is Republican consultant and Austin native at Matt Mikoyak. Yes, the real one. I've stopped Twittering long enough to introduce you to this week's TribCast.
Thank you, Matt. This is reporter Reeve Hamilton here with editor-in-chief Evan Smith.
How's it going? Matt Mikoyak.
He's a good sport.
Did we run out of everybody else to ask?
Oh, we went to a spot on our list.
I told him we wanted...
He was on the list somewhere.
Yeah. I told him we wanted M&M and he got it mixed up.
Oh, that was a good one.
Ross.
You like that?
That was modern even.
Great.
Right.
Been listening to Chrysler commercials. What can I say?
Now the kids are going to be hip to the podcast at this point.
Right. I thought you were going to make a Cab Calloway reference. But you went right up to it.
Reeve knows who Cab Calloway is. How about that?
Ross Ramsey, our managing editor, is also here.
Yes, I am.
Double R.
Yeah,
like double M for Mikoyak.
And Ben Philpott, who has nothing noteworthy about his name.
BP, I
the
spilled B, a lot
the
of
BP
oil.
Of the podcast. Yeah.
KUT and the Texas Tribune.
So they say.
Right. And
so what is Mikoyak doing now? Besides providing Mike Allen with the list of people on the Sunday shows. For
really, he still manages Potomac Flax, which is a blog about the...
But whose campaigns here? Is he still running Bill Flores' stuff?
I don't think so.
Yeah. Let's move on. We don't know.
Yeah.
It is clearly the summer after a legislative session.
It just drops off the table, doesn't it? You know, everybody's so relieved that they leave, and then you look up and you say, but what will we write about?
Well, or what are we going to talk about, Reeve?
I honestly don't know what we're going to talk about. But
we're talking about Ron Paul.
We should probably start.
We will talk about Ron Paul
We will talk about Ron Paul. I actually wanted to start with a little bit of culture, since we don't ever do that.
Yep.
A lot of us went to
Is that why you have wine and cheese sitting in front of you right now?
Yeah, well, that's how I like to work here at the office.
I think the Texas Tribune drunk cast would be hilarious, actually.
Well, we do have the live one coming
Monday
up on Monday.
At UT, right.
We do. We'll explain.
We'll explain
Cafe.
That
right.
at the end, yeah. But anyway, a lot of us went to a movie last night called Incendiary, made by Evan Fill in the
Steve
blank.
Mims, who is a lecturer in the radio, TV, film department at the University of Texas. He's a veteran documentary filmmaker and maker of all kinds of films. And Joe Bailey Jr., who's a law school graduate from UT, was a student of Steve's.
The movie is basically about the forensic science that has been at issue in the Cameron Todd Willingham case.
Right.
Cameron Todd Willingham, who was executed in 2004 for burning down his house with his children inside it.
In 1991. And has become kind of a death penalty cause celeb, but really it's less of a story about the death penalty than about innocence and about this forensic
about evidence,
science
right.
and about evidence.
Well, and this movie is going to get a theatrical release, at least in Austin. I don't know what its plans are exactly, but I was wondering if this issue, the Cameron Todd Willingham issue, will haunt Perry should he decide to make a presidential run.
One question I'd pose to the three of you is, why would it be an issue for Perry now when it failed to gain traction as an issue against Perry in the governor's race in 2010?
Because I hear that Democrats vote in national elections.
Ooh, zing.
Well, so, and it's a different election. I mean, you know, the death penalty doesn't play the same way in the other 49 states. It plays the same way in some of them as it does in Texas. You know, Texas is, you know, sort of number one in executions and number, you know, I mean, it polls, you know, we've done polls on this and Texans support the death penalty. There's really not any political question about it in Texas. And it makes your calculation different, I think, if you're playing to a Texas audience than it does if you're playing to a national audience.
Well,
and we find out now what the difference is.
That point, I remember, Ross, you and I had, and maybe others had conversations at the time about the Willingham case, saying that Kay Hutchison was in a difficult spot in a Republican primary. Because if she started attacking Perry about Willingham, then she would appear to be less than 100% for the death penalty, which in a Republican primary is a form of death itself.
Right.
Especially when you might also support abortions.
Well, she was not in the position to move to the center or
issues.
Even to the left on an issue. And so Willingham was kind of off limits for Hutchison's purposes. And then by the time we got around to the general, as you point out, that cake was pretty much baked.
No, but it's not like Bill White hammered home the Cameron Todd Willingham issue in his campaign. His campaign was basically, I am a safe conservative Democrat that Republicans can relate to. So he didn't go on the death penalty issue. Not that I think that the Cameron Todd Willingham issue is actually a death penalty issue, like you mentioned earlier.
Well, but they couldn't, you know, the problem here is you can't, in Texas, run that campaign. It doesn't work. Voters, you know, that's not the voters' position. If you're in another state, though, even Republican governors, George Ryan, I guess, before he went to jail, and, you know, some other governors have pulled this up as a Republican issue, and the line is usually, and it's here it was interesting, it was taken at our thing by Mark White, former governor. The line is not, are you for or against the death penalty? It is the death penalty being correctly run, and are you positive that you're or you're positive of their guilt before you kill them. And that's kind of where this argument is.
I think it's even more removed than that. It's, are you honest and interested in the truth? The problem with the Cameron Todd Willingham case is that there's just been this incredible 5-year delay in the investigation to try to figure out what happened. That seems highly political.
Provided, as was discussed last night by the panel following the screening, provided that you believe that statutorily the Forensic Science Commission even has jurisdiction to re-examine this case.
Well,
there
sort
is
of,
some dispute about that.
That's sort of a side issue. I mean, the delay was happening before that really was brought up.
Right, but the man is dead. The man was executed in early 2004. Not going to bring him back. Re-examination of the case is not going to bring him back. So what people who are interested in knowing what the outcome of this should be will say to you is, you know, we need to go back and determine whether he was innocent or not. In fact, I'm not sure that we can answer that question. I believe that the Forensic Science Commission needs to play this out. But I'm not certain in the end what you learn.
Going to Ross's point about what the debate is specifically in Texas, the commission should help figure out whether or not it is being administered correctly. And in other words, is there a science standard? Is good science being used? And if it wasn't used then good Lord, we need to make sure that it's being used correctly.
But there seems to be an acceptance of the fact that the science used back then was insufficient.
There seems to be an acceptance that the science used was inefficient.
Insufficient.
Right. But also that in this case it was okay. Well,
because
contradictory. The assumption being that he was guilty.
Governor Perry's famous line on this during the campaign was, he was a monster. We executed a monster. Matter what the science
was. He was quoting Cameron Todd Willingham's lawyer when he said that. He said, Cameron Todd Willingham's lawyer wrote me a letter and said this guy was a monster. The way this plays in a national campaign, I think, is in the context of a Republican primary, and especially in a general, if he gets that far, is, was the death penalty properly administered while Rick Perry was governor? That's the conversation in this thing. It's not.
So this is Carla Faye Tucker?
Maybe so. Yeah, this was, you know, Carla Faye Tucker was the poster child for death penalty when George Bush was running. You know, every time a Southern governor with the death penalty in his or her state runs, this is an issue. And I think this is the case that they talk about.
Yeah, well, I don't know whether the Willingham case now, thanks to David Grant's piece in The New Yorker several years ago, the Willingham case is a much better known case to the rest of the country than it otherwise would have been. There's been a Frontline documentary, or there's about to be a Frontline documentary. I think there was
one. There already was one.
On this. And, you know, but of course, I believe that what you're getting at is the visible tip of an iceberg. And the part that is not visible, the part that's submerged, related, is really interesting, in which is, are there a whole host of issues, the death penalty being one, on which Rick Perry is not too conservative for Texas, but maybe too conservative for the rest of the country? So that regardless of what he does in a primary, when you get Rick Perry into a general election, unless the country has completely gone to hell, unemployment is 15%, they find Obama smoking crack in Kenya, unless the conditions are such that anybody can beat the incumbent president, I have a real question as to whether Rick Perry's positions on issues, not just the death penalty, but including, are too conservative for him to be elected president of this whole country, of all 50 states.
Right, is Texas in sync or out of sync with the rest of the other 49 states?
And Wayne Slater was on the Rachel Maddow show last night talking about the response and talking about these various pastors, including John Hagee of San Antonio, who, in clip after clip that she showed, I believe this was a video that the right-wing watch.
There's that blog that's just organization. You know, there's a liberal blog pushing out every clip they can find of these pastors that have endorsed this.
These guys make Jeremiah Wright look like, you know, Brer Rabbit. The stuff that was coming out of the mouths of these guys, again, including John Hagee. I mean, you know, I was reminded of something I had forgotten, which is that when John Hagee endorsed John McCain in the 2008 presidential campaign, and then 5 minutes later, John McCain discovered that Hagee had referred to the Catholic Church as the whore of Babylon, at which point John McCain threw it into reverse and began beeping like a garbage truck, pardon me. And then so much for the Hagee endorsement. And the reality is, you got John Hagee, but you got all these other folks too who are saying these things that, I mean, they pale, they make you blush. I mean, and they cause your hair to go white when you hear them. And so the question is that little universe of folks going to be a problem for
Jeremiah Wright was painted as un-American. I don't think that they would do that with these people. Although the things they say are things like Oprah is leading the, you know, gang of harlots that's going to bring down the country and stuff like that.
It's
not Oprah, it's Nancy Grace, Reeve.
That's the modern day interpretation.
The first line of attack here is that you're politicizing religion and you shouldn't do that. But what actually happens? What actually kicks back on these things in the Wright case, and to some extent in the case of this thing, is it's not that the politics are getting into religion; it's that the religion is getting into the politics. And some of this religion is out there. It sounds fringy when you put it in a political campaign.
Well, we need to ask the son of a Methodist member of the clergy. Right. What do you think about that?
We got a PK on the staff here.
Come on,
well, preacher you know kid. I think it is very interesting that it's. You know, I watched this morning. This is funny. I was waiting for my turn in the shower this morning and was watching.
They'll stand in the hall with their towel and their bar soap.
Right.
Here at camp.
And, you know, I was flipping through the channels. And
let's just move on. Let's just leave it at that.
Is all six of our podcast listeners throwing up.
But I was flipping through the channels and the John Hagee telecast was on at 6:30 in the morning.
Cornerstone
and
Church. Here we
so
go.
So I was watching it, and the reason I was watching it is because, you know, I mean, five people don't go to this church. Thousands of people go to this church.
Tons of people.
Millions of people across the country watch his broadcast, and it's really interesting to listen to, you know, the message that he gives, and but people are listening to that message, and especially in Texas, you know, he doesn't have to apologize for it. I think it will be interesting to see if he tries to, you know, back at all if he gets into this national campaign. But it's a message that a whole lot of people believe in. And, you know, it's also a message that comes from the idea of the truth of the Bible, as Hagee was actually saying this morning very clearly in his sermon that I saw. And, you know, that's a truth that if you campaign against it, I say that loosely, you're not a Christian, you're atheist, you...
Right.
You're not a Christian, you're attacking Christianity.
You're attacking Christianity. I mean, that's one of those, you know, so it's one of those tricky things. If you're on the other side of this, to come out and say, well, these people are horrible. Oh, you mean these Christians?
Right.
And all the, I mean, what, they're getting together and praying for, you know, the country to...
Save America.
...improve and... And there's nothing wrong with that. Exactly.
I mean, that's really tricky in Texas now. Is it tricky in other states? I don't know. But it does, it puts you on, especially if, I mean, let's say if the message just gets out of hand. Let's say that there's some atheist group out of Tennessee that decides to, you know, put out an ad and says, you know, vote for Obama because Perry's got these crazy Christians helping him out. You know, and then I'm sure that the president doesn't want that. Let's be sure
the issue is in context. These people are entitled to their views. The folks
Absolutely.
Who are on these videos are entitled to their views, and the governor is certainly free to associate with them or not, or welcome their support or not. But remember the underlying question here. The issue is not whether in Texas this plays well.
Right.
The issue is whether around the rest of the country this plays well. And I wonder whether this governor, if you extrapolate him up to all 50 states, runs into a buzzsaw in a general.
I don't know that he does in a primary. And you know,
in a general.
I know. Yeah. I don't know that he does in a primary. And, you know, you have to take these things one at a time. You know, you have to win the primary. The question I have is whether you have to run so far right in the primary to win the primary.
I don't think you do.
That you disqualify yourself for the general election.
Do you think you do? I don't think you do.
Well, you know, the way this is framing up is that the moderate Republican vote, you know, quote unquote, air quotes here, right, is probably Mitt Romney at this point in midsummer, you know, 5-6 months before we vote. So Perry positions himself to the right of Mitt Romney. So how far right do you go to win that primary? And how far back do you have to bring yourself for the general election? I think that's really kind of the question.
Well,
but Southern governors have been doing this for a while. I mean, you know, you can do all kinds of stuff in the primary that doesn't seem to stick to you in the general election, and I don't know that this will stick to you.
But that was a question. Who's the last example of that, though?
I think Bill Clinton ran left in the Democratic primary in 92 until you know, certainly against Gary Hart. And then when Tsongas came out, he ran a little bit to the right of him and started triangulating.
But the bigger issue would have been if Bill Clinton had been a total unreconstructed liberal and ran to the, you know, I think it's easier for somebody from the center to run to play to the base in the primary and then return to their natural place in the general.
Yeah, and that's what you were asking earlier, is can Perry, does Perry have that pivot muscle? I mean, he hasn't.
Has he had to pivot in?
He hasn't needed it in Texas.
Well, he hadn't had to do it. He hadn't had to do it in ages, and you know, he had to do it a little bit in the. You could argue he had to do it a little bit in the primary. Had to come a little bit to the middle to meet Kay, but he didn't have to come very far. The other thing here is that I'm not sure Perry has to.
You think Perry moved to the middle in the
primary? I do a little bit.
Really?
Yeah.
Can you tell me an issue on which he moved to the middle?
Off the top of my head, no. Only give me a minute.
He wasn't a birther.
The thing that. That catches me here is that I'm not sure Perry has to come back much in the general election if Obama's still in the same economic condition he's in right now. I think it's basically a, do you want the guy who's in office in a bad economy, or do you want to change? And, you know, it's going to be less, that election's less about Perry than it is a referendum on Obama.
So it retreats into the classic change versus more of the same pose.
Right.
But there's no point at which you think he just, if you get too far right, because I mean, running to the right of Romney is one thing, whatever. But if you're running to the right of Michelle Bachmann,
how are you going to get to the right of Michelle Bachmann?
I don't know that you do.
How can you?
You could have a massive prayer and fasting
Perry's
event
campaigning
down in Houston.
I think it would be an extraordinary act to find room between Michelle Bachmann and the farthest far end of that.
It'd be a real trick to get. If you get to the right of Michelle Bachmann, you're not going to win the primary.
You don't think the response toes that line a little bit?
I don't know that it does. And I'm going to actually give you a specific reason why I think Perry's not to the right of Michelle Bachmann and won't go there. Bachmann and Santorum have signed this pledge in Iowa. The contents of which are extreme, I think, even by the standards of what we've come to understand as the reset of basic Republican positions are. My suspicion is Rick Perry does not sign that pledge.
Mitt Romney has already said he won't.
Well, Romney won't sign it. Gingrich won't sign it.
They've taken the slavery language out of it, at least since they sent.
I don't believe Rick Perry signs that pledge, and I think the reason is that it represents a view of the world that, even by Rick Perry's very conservative standards, may be out of sync with the mainstream,
the majority.
Well, truly, I do. I don't think you get to the right of Michelle Bachmann. I think Rick Santorum is going to be a trivia question pretty soon. I don't think he has any traction in this race from what I can tell. Certainly none of the polls do. Huntsman is showing no sign of catching on. Obviously, right. It's early. Palenti, the Quinnipiac poll that had Perry in fourth behind Romney, Bachmann, and Palin, had Palenti behind Gingrich and Herman Cain.
How high were Bachmann's numbers in that poll?
I think Bachmann was 14%.
See, I have
Palin was 10%. Romney was about 25%. Perry was 10%.
I'm going to be very curious to watch the numbers if and when Perry gets in, to watch what happens to Bachmann's numbers. I mean, you know,
you think that he takes from her.
I think that he takes the food right off of her plate, and I think that he's going to appear to be a more experienced version for that same audience. I think they're going to say, well, if we're not already committed to her,
hasn't accomplished anything. He has.
Well, she just hadn't been at it as long. She hadn't been in an executive position. Accomplishment really in a national race is, she's pretty good at cable TV. She's been out there a while.
But, you know, you have Palenti, who's from her own home state, saying she's accomplished nothing legislatively.
Right, right.
So Perry can come up and say, look what I've done over the last 10
right.
years.
You know, well, Perry, Palin, and Bachmann are looking for the same votes.
Perry has more business, right. The business credentials that those two don't have.
Right.
So he appeals, he's like Bachmann plus. Right, he's right. Like so Google Plus. He's the Bachman. Right. He's the newest.
I suspect that you push. You know, if you're Perry's campaign, I suspect that you get into this thing. You run to the right of Newt Gingrich and you push Bachmann as far right as you can, marginalize her, and try to take it out of the middle with your business votes. You know, here's my conservative vote. Here's my business vote.
Anybody here doubt that he's running?
Not at this point.
I got two bets on it, as I've said before.
What do you think?
I don't doubt it. No.
I mean, he's making it. It would be a hell of a head fake.
It'd be the
red herring. But if he's underscore red,
what he's doing is he's setting himself up for anything, right? I mean, he's sort of, his stature is rising to the point where if he suddenly decides not to be president, there are probably going to be a number of national options.
Okay, but if he doesn't run, isn't there going to be a line of conversations like, buddy.
No, but he
what you did was freeze. You froze the race. You froze the race in place all these months. You ended up not running. All you did was basically hurt other Republicans' ability to raise money and to be out there because you froze the race while you decided.
Well,
so if you don't run, aren't you responsible for making it even harder for the Republicans to win?
But depends on how he does that.
If you run, let's say he runs and loses the primary, does he become the guy that the Republicans should have nominated, or does he get into that situation where it's like, oh, well, you know, you had your chance and you lost the first time?
If he doesn't run and if he doesn't run in the proper way, if he decides not to run for president and he does it properly, he's the vice president. He's the candidate.
Yeah, I have to believe that if Romney is the nominee, Romney's going to need to balance himself out geographically and ideologically. I think Michelle Bachmann, I'm sorry, is a liability on that ticket because I think Michelle Bachmann is associated with positions that even by the standards of today's Republican Party are somewhat outside of the mainstream.
Did you say they pulled an acorn on her husband?
What does that mean?
They went in some
they videotaped him secretly.
They Breitbarted her.
The pray for no more gay stuff, right? Is that what it is?
Well, he can cure you of being
gay. Here's the thing. I think that Bachmann is not a benefit to Romney on the ticket. The Bachmann base may be energized, but I'm not convinced that Bachmann is as beneficial to Romney as Perry might be.
Yeah, I mean, Perry's a Southern governor, fiscal conservative, social conservative, Christian.
What is the role of the person? Is the role of that person is to be the attack dog and to play to the base? Perry can do both those things with his eyes closed.
I think he's got plenty of room to get out of this thing. I think he's got, you know, if you do it with some, you know.
But the enthusiasm for Romney seems to be so tepid.
It's the summer. It's July. People are like, you know, except for political reporters, people are yawning.
Dude, what's going to change? With Romney, what's going to change?
I have a suggestion about what's going to change in terms of who's paying attention. I mean, who's paying attention right now?
It's us.
I think it's the activists on both sides.
Not
right?
Even
Matt McCovey. Yeah.
I think it's the activists though on from both parties, and the activists on the Republican Party right now are dominated by Tea Party folks, and the Tea Party folks are not excited with Romney.
Well, they've pledged to defeat Romney.
Right.
So they don't want Romney.
So when more people pay attention. The assumption, I guess, is kind of like going from primary to general. The assumption is that when more people are paying attention, the vote as a whole will become more centrist. And then Romney appeals to people that are paying attention. But I don't know. Because I've never run a campaign.
I don't know what Romney does that gets this thing exciting. I mean, there's an idea, I don't know what that campaign's going to roll out as they go through Iowa and as they go through New Hampshire. I think right now, you know, the problem with analyzing those kinds of things right now is that everything in these races at the moment is all tactical.
Yep.
It's all, you know, I'm talking to this guy in Iowa and I'm talking to that guy in New Hampshire, and it's like, you know.
Well, one of the tactics is that Romney is not competing actively in Iowa.
Right.
And so what's going to happen is that somebody, not Romney, will win Iowa. Mm-hmm. And if it's Bachmann, that's good for Romney because Bachmann's not going to play as well in a lot of other states around the country.
Right.
If it's Pawlenty, that's bad for Romney because he's reanimated.
Right.
If it's Perry, that's bad for Romney.
Because Perry
is the kind of candidate who can come into New Hampshire however little time later and maybe pull a sneaky Sullivan on him and snatch New Hampshire or be a strong second and really destabilize Romney's front-runner position.
Perry, as conservative as he is, can moderate his stance as he did with Kay. And this kind of, just now that I've thought about it for a minute, this is kind of what I was thinking about. He ran against Kay, to the right of Kay, primarily on the life issue. Primarily, she's pro-choice, and then coming around to a pro-life position, he's been pro-life all along. So he solidifies that part of the base. But then he comes back and says, you know, we've done this with the economy, we've done this with jobs. Those are things that appeal to Republicans who aren't necessarily social conservatism isn't their main thing or isn't their thing at all. And I think in a race with Romney, I mean, and I think part of the reason that Perry would be damaging to Romney in Iowa is that he checks that social conservative box that Bachmann would have checked or that Palin would check. But he also gets some of what Pawlenty gets. He also gets some of what Romney gets. He eats a little bit off their plate. He comes over and says, you know, I'm look at the Texas business thing, look at economic development. All of those kinds of things appeal to fiscal conservatives without necessarily alarming them about him being a
They've been governors. I've been governor. Right. Pawlenty had to shut down the state government in Minnesota because when he was governor.
I cut $15 billion from the budget and left $6 billion in the piggy bank.
For now.
Without shutting the thing down.
Romney's state while he was governor was 47th out of 50 in job creation.
Right.
Our state was number one.
Right. Right.
So you moderate your stance not by giving in on your previous positions, but by choosing which topics you discuss.
Yeah, you're talking about – I'm going to talk about the stuff over here in the fiscal conservative stuff to this audience. I'm going to talk about the social conservative stuff in this audience. The danger of something like the response, if it were close to an election, is that you risk alarming the people who were otherwise with you about your social conservatism. This thing is far enough in front of an election that I don't think it does that. And, you know, if Hagee is out there and these other preachers are out there whispering to their congregations in some form or another that, you know, you guys vote however you want, I'm voting with Rick Perry, that doesn't hurt him.
The other possibility is that Perry goes all in on this faith stuff. Maybe he announces at the response. I mean, it's counterintuitive by any imagination.
If he announces at the response, it's a, you know, we've got a religious candidacy and we're going to have to get out a litter and bring Caesar in with a, you know, and it's just going to look like
But maybe his thing is that the terms of the conversation have been so upended by the last couple of years that maybe he wants to make a naked play for people of faith and he wants to announce at the thing. I mean, I happen to think it's not something he's going to do, but I guess until he doesn't do it, it's a possibility.
Right.
Can we move a little bit to another presidential candidate who's...
Evan,
can we pick up the
Ben,
stuff we're dropping
moved,
on the
ben
floor?
Ben moved really rapidly there. Sorry. Right.
Ben dropped his Gary Johnson pro-pot bumper sticker on the floor there. So.
Anyway... Things are really
parse that at home. This is the home game.
So this is like the Gingrich campaign.
I did not get clean for Gene. I don't know what you're talking about.
Let's talk about Ron Paul. You know, which positions do you think he's going to run on?
Gold standard.
He's going to run on the position. He's going to run. You know, the thing about Ron Paul is that Ron Paul has always run on the same stuff, and he's one of those candidates, for better or for worse, who has said, "I believe these things, and this is what I'm running on." And if it's not these things, I'm not going to compromise just because you're wearing the same color jersey I am. I mean, there's any number of votes in either of his runs in Congress where the Republican Party has been in position A and the Democrats have been in position B and Ron Paul's been in position C. But if you look at him against the ideology that he presented to his voters, he's always kind of in sync. There's no tension in this at all.
Well, did you see the, kind of illustrating that, did you see the press release that the Texas Democratic Party put out after he announced he was retiring?
We should mention that he announced that he's not going to run for Congress again.
Right.
In order to concentrate on his 2012 race for president.
Or as Dave Weigel of Slate tweeted, Ron Paul not running in 2012 so he can devote his time to losing the 2012 presidential race.
Well, exactly.
We're talking about the end of Ron Paul's career.
Right.
The end of Ron Paul's political career is in sight.
Right.
Because he's not going to win the primary.
Right.
And he's not running for Congress again, so Ron Paul will be out of politics. By, you know.
Right. After what, a quarter of a century?
Yeah.
I will say, though, more than a quarter of a century, I will say, though, that this is what everybody said when he quit Congress to run for the Libertarian presidential, as a Libertarian.
Well, he came back twice.
He came back twice. I mean, you know.
He's been in Congress three different times,
the unsinkable. Right? Yeah. I still think Ron Paul's a really interesting political character. I still think if he were to change tack, there's no indication that he will, that he's sort of the secret, what could really blow up the U.S. Senate race in Texas. You know, if Ron Paul got in that race, that's a whole different can of wax. But, you know, running this thing, he's going to get 15 or 20%. If you go back and take this apart and say, okay, what did Ross Perot do to George Bush in 1992? Does Ron Paul take enough votes off of the conservative candidate in a Republican primary to get the moderate candidate through? In some states.
I think it's a very difficult scenario to imagine a moderate candidate in this climate making it through the Republican primary as the nominee. You know, Romney accepted only because the advantages he enjoys over the others are so great. But Romney and Dewhurst, to go back to last week's conversation about the Senate race, have a similar challenge. They have a similar opportunity and a similar challenge. In this climate, is that the right person to carry the flag of the party?
Right, right.
I don't know.
So Ted Cruz and Rick Perry are the same guy in that scenario.
You see, three former Republican Party chairs in Texas, Kathy Adams, Tina Benkheiser, and George Strake, all endorsed Ted Cruz today.
And so did George P. Bush earlier this week.
The Senate race, George P. Bush yesterday. Right. You got to give the Cruz campaign credit, you know. They're
working it.
In the run-up to the Dewhurst announcement, which we expect by the time you hear the podcast next week, Dewhurst is theoretically going to be in this race. They're doing everything they possibly can to demonstrate that they're going to go toe-to-toe with this guy.
Sometime in the next few days, we're going to see their money. See how they're doing.
The Cruz money.
Right. Well, yeah, right. The Cruz money. Dewhurst didn't get it because of his timing. If he gets into this race, you're not going to see his money till September. But you are going to see Cruz's money. You're going to see Leppert's money, Elizabeth Ames Jones's money. Who am I leaving out?
That's it so far.
So, you know, we'll see how they're doing in the money race. The question's going to be, is anybody going to have the money to go toe-to-toe with Dewhurst in a way that it becomes an argument about ideas or issues instead of an argument about, well, I've seen candidate A, but I haven't seen candidate B.
One of the things that we can talk about if we have time left is the fact that we have no time left.
You're you can just mention what it would have been.
How about with no verbs? Dominoes falling. So Paul doesn't run, and so now Larry Taylor is looking at the race.
Right.
You know, there's word yesterday that Mike Jackson is looking at a congressional race, although not necessarily that race.
Not that one, right. Well,
Nick Lampson might get into the Paul
Nick
race
Nick Lampson's
also,
looking
right?
at this thing.
At the Ron Paul race.
Yeah. It's very similar to the district that
bunch of libertarians,
won,
too.
And, you know, the Tom DeLay district.
Yeah. You know, you got Gary Walker, a former Republican House member, challenging Jim Lamtrup, a Republican freshman, right. in that district up in the Panhandle.
Right.
You've got the possibility of Leo Berman resigning, or retiring, I should say.
Right. Kelly Hancock maybe running for Wendy Davis's seat in the U.S. and in the Texas Senate. You're starting to see these things trip all over the state. You know, James White and Tuffy Hamilton have been mentioned as possible congressional candidates. There's a Lufkin school board member, pretty well thought of on that end of the district, who's going to run against Marva Beck. Her district now, instead of going toward Waco, goes south toward Lufkin.
Yeah.
There's this weird district that Lloyd Doggett left. It's kind of an interesting thing. You know, the district that his house is actually in goes from Hays County all the way to Tarrant County border. And, you know, you could get all kinds of weird regional politics in that thing. Somebody's going to be driving a lot.
So is this going to be a particularly crazy election season?
It almost always is after
redistricting.
Right?
Yeah, sure.
We've got that. We've got a bunch of turmoil. We've got, you know, the Tea Party and the moderates, or however you want to frame the two-party system that happens inside the Republican primary. I mean, you know, I think that's going to be a really interesting piece of politics.
And you have the Democrats trying to figure out where they fit
right.
on this landscape.
Right.
And I think probably the biggest question, of course, is who is Matt Mikowiak going to be working for? We should probably turn
does
it over.
Does he tell you in the little ending
well,
that he recorded for us here?
Matt,
let's see.
Matt?
Come on, Matt.
This is Matt Mikowiak. If you have questions, complaints, or concerns, you can email podcasts. podcasts@texastribune.org.
All right. Thank you, Matt.
Did I hear that correctly? He's working for Russ Feingold in the Democratic primary against Obama?
I think if you play that backwards, that's what it says.
Aren't you supposed to do a promo?
For our Monday thing?
Yeah, the Monday thing.
Yes. We will either announce or not announce who Matt Mikowiak is going to be working for at our Monday event, which Evan probably knows more of the details about than I do.
You think I might, since it's a KUT event, maybe.
I just felt more comfortable with the announcement in Evan's hands.
No, Ben Philpott.
So KUT is the lovely holder of Cactus Cafe, the historic music site on the University of Texas campus.
They'll be lovelier when they're in the new offices.
Weirder and weirder. Anyway, second word into the sentence, he already threw himself off.
We're
at the Cactus Cafe. It's called Views and Brews. It's a evening of discussion. Lasts from 6 to 7 o'clock. We're going to be doing the TribCast live there for the first 20 minutes, 30 minutes, and then take questions from the audience. It's first come, first serve, free and open to the public. Only holds
cash
about...
Cash bar.
Yes, cash bar. They're at the Cactus Cafe. It's the bar on campus that was brought up, I guess, during one of the legislature or somebody... it was during the...
higher ed cuts.
Yeah, whether or not there were a bar on campus. Oh, there is.
So, and this is Monday.
Monday night from 6 to 7.
July 18th.
Something else happening that day?
Dewhurst may or may not announce.
All right. Well, that'd be something we'll talk about on Monday, right, if it happens.
If our event happens or if he announces?
If he announces.
Yeah. Stay tuned. On behalf of Evan, Ross, Ben, our producer Todd, this is Reeve. Thanks for listening.
Now I'd like to introduce Evan Smith, Ben Philpott, and some schmuck.
You get Bill Powell.